He was a third grader. But he listened carefully to her complaint, inspected her head, and then told her the story of Rapunzel, whose long hair had allowed her to escape from prison. "If only we could," Katie thought now, an echo of her earlier impatience with the town. "If only."
"Ro?"
Mrs. Finn had come all the way out on the porch now. She was a gaunt woman with wide, needy eyes, the corners of her mouth pinched downward in disapproval. Katie, who had been thinking of inviting herself to dinner, suddenly decided to go home.
"Ro, come in now."
"My mother might not find us," Ro continued, "but yours would."
"You're right. Mum's a bloodhound."
"Ro,"
his mother called again,
"where have you been?"
Ro smiled, trapped, and trudged away up the path to his porch. Katie turned and continued up the lane. Ro lived on one of the higher slopes of the hill, but Katie's house was at the very top, right next to William Tears. He was well protected, Tear was, with Mum's house on one side and Maddie Freeman's on the other. No one in town wanted to tangle with either of them.
"Katie?"
Mrs. Gannett, calling from her porch. Katie wanted to keep walking. Mrs. Gannett was nothing but a gossip. But that sort of thing always got back to Mum. She halted and waved.
"He's over at your house," Mrs. Gannett told Katie.
"Who?"
"You know."
Mrs. Gannett lowered her voice almost to a whisper.
"Him. Tear."
With an effort, Katie kept from rolling her eyes. She knew she was supposed to worship Tear as everyone did, but whenever she heard someone speak Tear's name with reverence, a rogue part of her longed to call Tear names and prove that he wasn't much. But she didn't dare. There was something about Tear, perhaps only the way he had of looking at her, grey eyes piercing. Those eyes scared Katie. They seemed to see right to the core of her, things she didn't want anyone else to know. She tried never to speak directly to him. She liked Lily, Tear's wife, not wife, her mind reminded her. William, Tear, and Lily had never been married. But then everyone liked Lily. She was one of the few genuine women in Katie's acquaintance, but Katie sensed that Lily's honesty had been hard won. But there was something sorrowful about her as well. A melancholy that Katie glimpsed from time to time when Lily didn't think anyone was watching. Did William Tear see it too? He must, for he seemed to see everything. The sun was just beginning to set as she crested the hill, but all of the lamps were already lit, flickering gently as the candles inside were buffeted by the light evening wind. That was another apprenticeship Katie could choose, learning to make candles. She had no interest in going anywhere near the town beehives, but Mum had told her that beekeeping was separate, that candle makers only had to deal with the wax. Katie didn't know why the apprenticeship was so much on her mind today. It was still months away. Maybe because it would be a sure sign that she was growing older. She was so tired of being young.
"Katie!"
She looked up and found Mum waiting for her on the porch, her hands on her hips. Her hair was tied up into a messy bun, and her shirt was splattered with bits of what looked like stew. Some days she drove Katie crazy, but on other days, like today, Katie was swept with a sudden wave of love for her mother, who was so stubborn that she even refused to wear an apron while she cooked.
"Come on, Rags," Mum told her,
giving her a hug and ushering her inside. "We've got company." All of the lamps in the house had already been lit, and as Katie's eyes adjusted to the low light in the living room, she saw William Tear and Aunt Maddie by the fireplace, talking in low voices. "Katie, girl," Aunt Maddie said, turning around, "how are you?" Katie hugged her happily. Even though Maddie Freeman wasn't her real aunt, Katie loved her almost as much as she loved Mum. Aunt Maddie knew how to have fun. For as long as Katie could remember, she had always been the one who could think of a good game or a way to pass a rainy afternoon indoors. But she was also a good listener. It was Aunt Maddie who had told Katie about sex when she was 9, 2 years before Mrs. Warren broached the subject at school, and long before Katie could bring herself to raise the topic with Mum. Aunt Maddie's hug nearly crushed her. She was strong enough to work on the farm, or in the stockyards for that matter. But if Aunt Maddie had any job, it was advising William Tear. Mum, Aunt Maddie, Evan Olcott. Tear never went anywhere without at least two of them along, and despite Katie's ambivalence about the man himself, she couldn't help being proud when she saw Mum or Aunt Maddie at his side. "Come on out to the backyard with me, Katie," Aunt Maddie told her, and Katie followed, wondering whether she was in trouble. Aunt Maddie didn't have kids of her own to worry about, so she had far too much time to spend keeping an eye on Katie. Their backyard was wide open, separated from the other houses only by a round pole fence that Mum had built in order to keep out the Cadell's dog. The sun hung low over the houses, a blinding ball of orange just touching the horizon. Katie could still hear the shouts of other children several houses over, but they would soon quiet down. The town was always quiet at night. Aunt Maddie sat down on the broad wooden bench under the apple tree and patted the space next to her. "Sit down, Katie." Katie sat, her anxiety increasing. She hardly ever misbehaved, but when she did, it was usually Aunt Maddie who caught her. "You start as an apprentice next year," Aunt Maddie remarked. So this was to be a discussion about her future, not her past. Katie relaxed and nodded. "Do you have any idea what you'd like to do?"
"I want to work at the library, but Mum says everyone wants to work there and it's a fight to get in."
"That's true. Ms. Ziv has more helpers than she knows what to do with. What's your second choice?"
"Anything, I guess."
"You don't care?" Katie looked up and found, to her relief, that she was not speaking to Aunt Maddie the disciplinarian. There were two Aunt Maddies, and this was the sympathetic one. The one who had helped Katie hide a dress she'd ruined in a mud fight when she was 7 years old.
"I'm just not interested," Katie admitted. "I know there are some apprenticeships I'd hate for sure, like beekeeping, but even the ones I wouldn't hate, I just don't care about."
Unexpectedly, Aunt Maddie smiled. "I have an apprenticeship for you, Katie girl, one I think you'll like. Your mother has approved it, but it needs to be a secret."
"What kind of apprenticeship?"
"You can't tell anyone."
"Not even Ro?"
"Especially not Ro," Aunt Maddie replied. Her face was deadly serious, and the protest Katie had been formulating died on her lips.
"I can keep a secret," she replied.
"Good." Aunt Maddie paused for a moment, clearly choosing her words. "When we crossed the ocean, we left behind weapons, and therefore much of our ability to defend ourselves from violence. We didn't believe we would need such things here. You've read about weapons, haven't you? Katie nodded slowly, thinking of the book beside her bed in which men shot other men with guns. There were no guns in the town, only knives and arrows, and those were used for hunting and trades. No one was even allowed to carry a knife in the streets. Before the crossing, your mother and I were both trained as weapons, Aunt Maddie murmured, her gaze fixed on some far distant place. We had guns, but we didn't need them. We learned to kill with our bare hands.
Kill people?
Katie blinked, trying to wrap her mind around this idea. Such things happened all the time in books, but they were only stories. She tried to picture Aunt Maddie or Mum killing someone, and found that she had no idea what that would even look like. To her knowledge, only one man in town had ever died by violence, and he had been killed by a marauding wolf out on the plains years ago. There had been an argument about it at meeting, though Katie had been too young to understand at the time. Several people had demanded that guards be posted around the edges of the town, guards with bows. Such decisions were always made by democratic vote, but William Tyr had spoken against the motion, and when William Tyr said no, there was only one way for a vote to go. Katie looked down at Aunt Maddie's hands, then at her arms, muscular and dotted with scars.
"Is that why you always follow William Tyr around?" she asked. "In case you have to kill someone?"
This time it was Aunt Maddie who blinked. "Of course not. We just want to be there in case he needs anything." Aunt Maddie had just lied to her, Katie thought. She did not take offense. Adults lied all the time. Their reasons, often as silly as those of children, but it was odd that, in a conversation that had contained so many other surprising bits of honesty, Aunt Maddie would feel the need to lie about this.
"We want to start your apprenticeship early, Katie, next month. We want to train you, just as your mother and I were trained, to meet violence when it comes."
"Why? What violence?"
Aunt Maddie's face seemed to shudder. Even her eyes became blank with concealment. "Probably no violence at all, Katie. This is just a precaution." Another lie. And Katie felt anger stir inside her now, a crouched animal, waiting.
"Does it have something to do with the graveyard?"
she asked, thinking of those torn open graves, their contents strewn pitifully across the grass. They said it was an animal, but privately, Katie had wondered. Wouldn't animals have torn up the entire place? Whatever had dug into the ground had apparently targeted 3 or 4 specific graves.
"No," Aunt Maddie replied. "But there may be other dangers. Consider yourself a preventative measure."
"Just me?"
Katie asked, thinking of her size. She wasn't tiny, but she wasn't tall either, and she was slight. If she had to fight a man with her bare hands, she would probably lose, training or no.
"No. We've chosen several young people. Your friend Virginia, Gavin Murphy, Jonathan Tyr, Leah Williams, Jess Alcott, a few others."
"But not Roe?"
"No. Roland Finn won't be a part of this. And he's to know nothing about it."
For a moment, Katie felt her anger begin to uncoil. Ro had so many gifts. Why couldn't the adults recognize them at least once? The lack of acknowledgement hurt Ro, though he did his best to hide it, and Katie felt that hurt as though it were part of herself.
"Do you want to do it?"
Aunt Maddie asked. Katie swallowed, trying to tame the animal inside her. She did want to do this, but it would mean keeping a secret from Ro. Could she even do that? They had no secrets. Ro knew everything about her.
"Can I think about it?"
"No." Aunt Maddie's voice was kind but implacable.
"You need to decide now."
Katie stared at the ground, her thoughts racing. She did want to do this. She'd never hidden anything from Ro, but she thought she could, just this once. She wanted to be in on the secret.
"I'll do it."
Aunt Maddie smiled, then crooked her finger toward the house. Katie turned and saw William Tyr striding toward them. Without thinking, she hopped off the bench to stand up straight. Aunt Maddie gave her shoulder one final squeeze before she left, but Katie barely noticed her go. The only other time she could remember being alone with William Tyr was last year at dinner, when they had both gone to the kitchen for seconds at the same time. Katie had waited, frozen, not knowing what to say to him, relieved when he took his plate back to the table. Now was no better.
"No need to be frightened, Katie."
Tyr settled himself into Aunt Maddie's spot on the bench.
"You're not in trouble. I just wanted to talk to you."
Katie nodded and sat back down, though a muscle in her leg was shaking and she had to fight to keep it still.
"Do you want this apprenticeship?"
"Yes."
Perversely, Katie felt her mouth wanting to open and let words tumble out. How she could keep a secret. How she would be a good fighter, never do anything to hurt the town.
"I know," Tyr said, making Katie jump. "That's a large part of the reason we've chosen you for this. It's not all fighting and knives, Katie. All the training in the world is worth nothing without trust. I've watched you for years. You have a gift, one we've all observed, a gift for seeing through artifice. The town will need that, and I won't always be here."
Katie stared at him, bewildered. She had never given much thought to Tyr's age, as she might do idly about the other adults in the town. Tyr had to be at least 50. But that was just a number. Tyr had no age. He simply was. But there was no mistaking the tone of his words.
"Are you sick, sir?"
"No." Tyr smiled. "I have years left in me, Katie. Just being cautious. Which brings us to this."
Reaching beneath his wool sweater, Tyr pulled out a tiny drawstring pouch that had been tied with a strip of deer thong. Katie had never noticed this pouch before, and she watched, interested, as Tyr thumbed it open and dumped the contents into his palm. A sparkling, deep blue jewel.
"Sapphire," Katie thought,
its many facets reflecting the waning sun. Plenty of people in town had jewelry, brought it with them in the crossing, but Katie had never seen a gem of this size. Tyr held it out to her, but for a moment she could only stare at it.
"Go on, take it."
She took the jewel and found that it was warm, probably from Tyr's chest. But Katie couldn't escape the odd idea that the stone was alive somehow. Almost breathing.
I want you to make me a promise, Katie. And be warned, it's quite a serious promise, not to be made lightly. The jewel you're holding has a way of making people regret their lies.
Katie clenched the sapphire in her fist and felt her hand heat around it, everything in her veins moving faster now. She looked up and saw something terrible. A drop of water, trickling down Tyr's cheek, incongruous with the world that Katie had always known.
Promise me, Katie. Promise to do what's best for this town. Always.
Katie's shoulders sagged in relief, because that wasn't such a hard promise to make. But Tyr was so clearly upset that she forced herself to speak slowly and solemnly, as though thinking through every word. I promise to do what's best for the town. She paused, and because those words didn't seem like enough, continued. If anyone ever tried to hurt the town, I'd stop them. I'd kill them.
Tyr's eyebrows rose. A fierce animal. Your mother said so. But no more talking of killing, all right?
He held out his hand, and Katie dropped the sapphire back into it.
I'm hoping it will never come to violence. This wasn't supposed to be a killing place.
Sir, can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Katie screwed up her courage. You have visions sometimes. Everyone says so.
Yes.
If the town is in danger, then from who? Don't you know?
Tyr shook his head. My visions are often little better than shadows, Katie. It may even be nothing at all.
But you don't think so?
No. Even when I only see shadows, they're usually true shadows.
He held up the sapphire, letting the last of the dying sun gleam through it.
This jewel is a powerful thing, but it has its limitations. It doesn't function on command. I can use it, but can't control it.
Where did you get it? From the old world?
Yes and no.
She stared at him, confused.
Someday, perhaps, I will tell you the story, Katie. But for now, just know that you've made a promise. A serious promise. We'll start next week. But until then, I'll ask you not to discuss this with anyone. Not even your friends. We haven't spoken to everyone yet.
Can I talk about it with Mum?
Of course. But no one else.
She hesitated, wanting to ask about Ro, why he wasn't included. Ro was surely the smartest teenager in town, except perhaps for Jonathan Tyr. But Aunt Maddie had mentioned Jonathan too, Katie recalled now. He was only a year older than Katie, but 3 years ahead of her in school, and far more distant than his age would suggest. Jonathan never accompanied his parents when they came over for dinner, and though he lived next door, Katie hardly ever saw him. He was fearsomely intelligent. Katie had heard that even after advancing him several grades, they'd been forced to create a special math class for Jonathan, some kind of calculus that no one else was ready to learn. But he didn't have any friends, and the word around school pegged him as some sort of misfit. No one bullied him because he was William Tyr's son, but the fact remained that he was different. Apart. Surely Roe would be no more stranger choice. Katie? She turned and found Tyr smiling at her a bit sympathetically, as though he had read her confusion. The jewel and its little pouch had already disappeared back under his sweater, but Katie barely marked these things. Rather, she was struck by Tyr's eyes, which were not grey or even light grey, but bright and translucent, almost silver in the fading sun.
"You don't have to be afraid of me any more," Tyr told her. "All right?"
Katie nodded, unable to stop herself from smiling back at him. She thought of all of her own sniping thoughts about Tyr and Tyr's sycophants, and felt suddenly ashamed. He was a good man, innately good. For a moment, Katie felt that goodness so powerfully that it almost seemed there was a rope binding them to each other, and she suddenly understood why Mum had followed this man across the ocean. "He only wants what's best for everyone," she thought. "Beneath all of the whispering and idol worship, that's the truth. I wish I could tell Roe."
"Thank you," Tyr said.
And for the rest of her life, Katie would never forget that moment. The tall man smiling at her, the hillside and river stretched out behind, and the blood-red sliver of sun hanging over them. She did not smile back this time, understanding somehow that it would undermine the gravity of the moment in her own memories, if not in fact.
"We'll go in now."
She walked beside him, listening to their feet scruff through the thin, scratchy grass, but her mind was elsewhere. Tyr was right. This business needed to remain a secret. Fighting and weapons? These things were so far outside the rules of the town that Katie couldn't even imagine what would happen if people found out. Virginia Warren, Leah Williams, Gavin Murphy, Jess Olcott, Jonathan Tyr, herself, a few others. But not Roe. Why not? She wondered, glancing sideways at Tyr's long legs, his thick wool shoes. "What does he know that I don't?" Mum was waiting for them, leaning against a wall just outside the kitchen door, her hands tucked behind her back.
"Done,"
Tyr told Mum, settling a hand on her shoulder.
"Fierce animal indeed, Dory. Just like her mother."
He went on inside and Katie looked up at Mum, not sure what came next. Mum was unpredictable. She could be surprisingly rational about Katie's mistakes, but then the oddest things would set her off sometimes. Mum was smiling, but her eyes were watchful. "You've never kept a secret in your life, Caitlin Rice, that was as important as this one."
"I know."
Katie debated for a moment, then blurted out,
"Mom, Roe's so smart. Why didn't they pick him, too?"
"Ah."
Mum leaned back against the wall, and Katie saw her searching for words. "Roe is an unpredictable boy."
"What does that mean?"
"Nothing. Come in and set the table." Katie followed silently, still trying to puzzle this out. Roe had a mischievous side, she knew that. He took delight in confounding others. But there was nothing malicious in it. Nothing that the two of them couldn't look back and laugh at later. She wanted to be angry on Roe's behalf, but all she could seem to feel was sadness. Only she got to see Roe's real value, and part of her liked that. It was like a secret between them. But in this moment, she would have traded all of that carefully guarded intimacy to have the rest of the town know him, see him clearly. And speaking of Roe, how was she going to hide all of this from him? An apprenticeship took up a lot of time. How was she supposed to keep Roe from finding out? Tyr will take care of it. The voice came from somewhere deep inside her, a place that felt disturbingly adult. But Katie recognized the truth of the thought. Tyr would take care of it. There was more than one secret being kept here. Katie sensed rings of concealment far outside herself, widening ripples in the deceptively smooth surface of the town. She thought of the enormous sapphire and shivered. She had promised to protect the town, and she had meant it. But deep down, that other side clamored, the part that was tired of worrying about others, the part that longed only to look after herself. "I can do both," she insisted. But it was a shrill sort of insistence, desperate, as though something inside her knew even then that such equivocation was false, that one day she would have to choose. Kelsey jerked to consciousness and found herself in darkness. The shadow of her jailer loomed nearby, making her tense up, but after a moment she saw that his head and chest swayed in time with the motion of the wagon. He was asleep. The sky over their heads was a deep, velvet black. Kelsey sensed that it was early morning, but there were no signs of dawn. "I saw." Light flared above the wagon. Kelsey looked up and saw an ornate street lamp passing over her head. At the same time, she realized that the ragged, bumpy motion to which she had become accustomed had transformed into an easy glide. They were back on smooth ground. The night air was nearly freezing, and Kelsey tucked the ends of her cloak back over her shoulders. Another street lamp danced by, a myriad of conflicting firelit shadows drifting across the floor of the wagon as it went. She should sit up, try to figure out where she was, but instead she merely lay there, frozen. "I saw," she breathed, as though words would make the thing real. "I saw." On impulse, she placed a hand on her chest, exploring. But of course there were no sapphires there. They were long gone. And yet, when Kelsey closed her eyes, there it was, laid out before her, the town, the forest, the Cadell, the Almont in the far distance. How was that possible? Even Lily's world had never been so clear. She's not Lily. No. This was a different girl, a child growing up in the Tierling, long before the kingdom had ever held that name. Her mother was Dorian Rice, who had once tumbled into Lily Mayhew's backyard with a bullet in her gut. The girl was Katie Rice. Years after the crossing, this scene, Jonathan Tyr only 14 years old. The idea made Kelsey's heart ache, for she knew that only 5 or 6 years later, Jonathan Tyr would be murdered, and William Tyr's utopia would be plunged into chaos.
so little time? How could everything have come apart? A puzzle, that. One with no solution, unless Kelsey went back and found the answers for herself. But she had learned through bitter experience that these little jaunts into the past could carry a terrible price. It's not like you're doing anything else right now. Kelsey smiled tiredly at the thought, a bit of pragmatism that reminded her of Mace. There was certainly very little she could do from this wagon. The cavalry had crossed the border and descended from the Argive Pass yesterday, leaving the bulk of the Mort army far behind. She didn't know whether the Red Queen had remained with her army or passed ahead in the night. She stared up at the sky, just beginning to lighten from black to deep blue. And for a moment she missed her country so badly that she thought she would weep again. She had left the tearling in Mace's hands, yes, and that was a comfort. But she couldn't escape the feeling that her kingdom was in terrible trouble. Above her head another street lamp passed, swinging slightly in the early morning wind. Even this bit of Mort organization galled Kelsey. Street lamps had to be lit at night and doused in the morning, or they were a waste of oil. Who came out here, in the middle of nowhere, to tend to all of these lamps? Again, Kelsey mourned her lost sapphires, for the street lamps seemed to tell their own valuable lesson. Fear bred efficiency. Not lost. The words made Kelsey jerk in surprise, for the voice deep in her mind was unmistakably Lily's. True, the sapphires weren't completely lost, but they were in the keeping of the Red Queen. They might as well be on the moon. The Red Queen couldn't use them, but neither could Kelsey. Why can't she use them? Lily's voice was miles distant, buried in her mind, but still Kelsey registered the urgency there. Think hard, Kelsey. Why can't she use them? Kelsey thought hard, but came up with nothing. Ro Finn had said something about tear blood. She struggled with the memory, which made her head ache. The Red Queen had tear blood, Finn had said, but Kelsey's was stronger. She had given the sapphires away, so how could she still be seeing the past? She suddenly remembered the dream she'd had a week ago, the crossing, the ships and the dark sky with a bright hole in the horizon. William Tyr had opened a doorway through time, and in her own limited way, Kelsey had done the same thing, prying open an aperture and peering into the past. Was it possible that the aperture had stayed open, even now when the sapphires were lost? If the crossing she had seen was real, it aligned neatly with what she had just seen here. Maddie Freeman, Lily's sister, years older, but alive and well. The sooner Kelsey got out of this wagon, the better. She was not in control during her fugues. Both Mace and Penn had told her so. She twisted to lie on her back, feeling slivers of wood dig into her cloak. If only she could reach out to them, to William and Jonathan Tyr, tell them of the storm-filled future, change history instead of just watching it play out. A skull appeared over her head. Kelsey bolted upright, clapping a hand to her mouth to stifle a gasp, and saw that the skull had actually been hung high in the air, mounted on a pike in between street lamps. A few traces of flesh still dangled from its jawbone. The eye sockets were crusted with blood long since aged black. She lost sight of the skull as the light from the street lamp faded away behind them. But then another street lamp appeared, and shortly afterward another skull. This one was very old. Wind and time had eaten away at the jawbone and the smooth curvature around the nose.
Well, there was at least one question answered. She was on the Pike Road. As quietly as she could, Kelsey stood up in the wagon, holding her chains so that they would not rattle and wake her jailer. Dawn was coming quickly now, the eastern horizon lined with pink, but the land below was a vast darkness, broken only by their current road, which was lined with pikes and street lamps. They were heading on a slight downhill slope, but in the distance, Kelsey could see that the road inclined sharply toward an enormous barrier. A wall, tall and well fortified, a black bulwark against the lightning sky. Above the wall, Kelsey saw the silhouettes of many buildings and, towering over all, a vast structure, tipped with spikes and oblongs that Kelsey identified as turrets. Domain, she thought, feeling something knot together in her stomach. Once it had been Evanston, the capital of New Europe, the city on a plateau built brick by settlers. But now it seemed like something out of a nightmare. Kelsey sat back down in the bed of the wagon, keeping an eye on her jailer who was beginning to stir, and wrapped herself up in her cloak. She tried to summon courage, but that well seemed to have dried up. She was in the middle of her own crossing now, but this voyage was nothing like William Tears. This was a journey into a dark land. When Ducat walked through the door, the Queen knew it was bad. She had waited days for this report, trying to be patient, though it ran directly counter to her nature, understanding that it would take Ducat some time to assess the situation. She had only sent him home from the border 2 weeks before. After the scene with the girl, Ducat was no more use as a commander, for it seemed he could barely keep himself together. He jumped at loud noises, and sometimes the Queen had to speak his name 2 or 3 times to get his attention. She had hoped that a return to his old duties, the position that he had created and made his own, might bring him back to himself. But as soon as Ducat entered her throne room, she saw that nothing had changed. If anything, he seemed worse than ever. Whatever the girl had done to him, she had done it well, perhaps even permanently. And without Ducat, the Queen's position became even weaker than before. She was facing a revolt. Despite her best efforts, word had leaked out that she was gone, and the rebel leader, Le Vieux, had laid siege to Cité Marche. None of the overgrown prats to whom she had delegated responsibility had made even the slightest headway in stopping this Le Vieux, or even in discovering his identity. Her army had finally returned from the Tierling, but slowly, even more slowly than on the outgoing journey. And in this lack of speed, the Queen sensed treachery. Before she departed, she had given explicit orders to Ducat's replacement, General Vine, that any man caught looting in the Tier be hung from the nearest tree. But General Vine was not a man to make an army tremble. Only fear of the Queen herself was keeping her soldiers in line now, and she sensed that fear steadily eroding. Her colonels and generals were loyal, for they knew they would be compensated for their share of plunder upon their return. But the rest of the army... Damn it! She needed Ducat now. How could he go and fall apart when she could least afford to lose him? But the Queen allowed none of this rancor to show on her face. Even half of Ducat's old competence, she reminded herself, was better than most men could boast. Behind him came two lieutenants, both of whom knew enough to take station behind Ducat and stay quiet. Their eyes cast respectfully to the floor.
"What news, Benin?"
Ducat tossed his cloak away and collapsed into a nearby chair. Another disturbing sign. Ducat had never liked to sit before. Now, he seemed to be constantly looking for the nearest support.
"Cité marches in chaos, Majesty. Last week, a mob broke into the Crown warehouses and removed everything, food and glass and steel and arms. The soldiers who were supposed to be on duty have disappeared. Mayor Juven has disappeared, and without him, no one has the authority to mobilize the city militia. I have the authority. Of course, Majesty. I didn't mean... Get the militia out there and find my property. That might be a problem, Majesty. We've caught a few people with glass or steel, but only a piece or two at a time. That rebel bastard Levieux has already distributed all of the goods, and he seems to have done it citywide. The food is probably gone already, and we'd have to arrest half the populace to take back the rest.
He stole only to give it away?
Apparently, Majesty.
The Queen remained still, but inside her muscles were jumping, galvanized by fury. It was not enough that she had expended a vast fortune to mount an invasion that had netted her nothing. Now she had to come home to this?
When you find Juven, I want him hung from the walls of Cité Marche. Yes, Majesty.
Ducat hesitated for a moment, then asked,
His head?
His whole body, she shouted. His whole body, Benin, alive. Once the crows have their way, we'll see how good a rebel he is.
Yes, Majesty.
Ducat repeated dully, and the Queen had to restrain the urge to leap from her throne and slap him. There had been a day once, almost 20 years ago now, when Ducat had taken a traitor from Calais and skinned the man alive, working slowly and methodically, impervious to the man's screams, shaving flesh with his knife as a sculptor would shave clay. The old Ducat would not have needed clarification. The old Ducat would simply have understood. The Queen took a deep breath, feeling everything tip precariously inside her.
What of Demain? At this moment, Demain seems relatively calm, Majesty. But I'll wager not for long.
Why not?
I sent several of my agents out into the countryside, Majesty, to assess the likelihood of a slave revolt. They found little to worry about from that quarter.
The Queen nodded. The penalties for runaway slaves had always been sufficiently severe to create an effective deterrent.
But there is a curious migration underway, Majesty. The villages of the Glass there have been abandoned. People are taking their livestock and whatever valuables they can carry, and moving southward. Many of them are already crammed into Cité Marche.
Why?
My people were too spread out to conduct proper interrogations, Majesty. This is only the word they were able to pick up from voluntary statements. There is an old superstition in the Fair Witch.
Ducat paused and coughed lightly.
A creature that supposedly stalks the mountains and foothills, seeking young prey.
The orphan,
the Queen murmured.
Majesty.
Nothing,
I know this superstition, Benin. It is older than I am. What has changed?
There are new reports, Majesty, of villages assaulted by not one, but an army of such things. My agent in Devin's copse found blood and bones on the floor of the empty houses. My people have found 8 villages so abandoned. 2 of my agents have gone missing themselves, more than a week overdue.
What is the alternate explanation?
The Queen asked, but her tone was hollow, for it was an empty question. The dark thing was on the hunt. She could tell Ducat so, but then he would ask for an explanation, and what story would she tell? Once, long ago, a frightened young girl fled from a village in the Glacevere. She was already in exile, and she had gone north to hide. But she found no comfort in the villages of the Glacevere, only abuse, so much so that she chose to starve in the mountains instead. She was prepared to die, but one night she saw a flicker of flame.
Again, I had no resources to interrogate these people, but I tell you, Majesty, they believed what they were saying. Something is at bloody work in the north, and if it continues to move south, the entire country will be knocking at our door for asylum.
The Queen leaned back against her throne, a pulse drumming unpleasantly in her temples. 2 weeks before, she had woken from a nightmare, the most terrible nightmare of her life, in which the dark thing, not phantom but solid, no longer bound by fire, chased her up and down the corridors of her castle, the length of the new world. Free, she realized. Call it the dark thing, call it the orphan. And those poor hunted villagers out in the Fairwitch certainly needed to call it something. To name the reason their children sometimes disappeared without a trace. But it was out now. Free to roam. And would it be coming in this direction? Was there even any doubt? Evie. The voice rang inside her head, but the Queen pushed it away, staring sadly at her oldest and most faithful ally. Ducat leaned forward now, resting his crossed arms on his knees and staring at the ground. He was not 60 yet, but he looked like an old man, worn and exhausted. The old General Ducat, the chief of internal security, whose name had made her entire kingdom tremble. That man was dead, and the Queen mourned him. Ducat had put down the Calain rebellion, had helped to transmute the Queen's grasp on Mortmain from wood to iron. But he was broken. And the Queen was only now awakening to the fact that sending Ducat to the Tierling might have been the gravest mistake she had ever made. Without him, there was no one to shield her, not even from the army itself. Have there been others? She wondered, feeling the question scurry in her mind back and forth like a panicked rodent. Other failures? How many mistakes have I made?
What do you want to do, Majesty?
The Queen tapped her fingers on the arm of her throne for a moment, then asked, almost idly,
Where's the girl?
Ducat's expression did not change, but his face paled a fraction, and in that moment, he seemed to grow older. The Queen didn't like to think of the girl, either. The memory of that scene in the tent was terrible, so terrible that she had pushed it to the bottom of her mind. The girl knew so much now. Evie. So many things that the Queen had meant to carry to her grave.
They brought her in yesterday, Majesty. She's in the dungeons, safe and sound.
but Dukat winced as he spoke.
I want her well guarded.
You worry about jailbreak, Majesty?
Of course not. I worry about her dying in custody. Your people don't have the best record in this department, Benin. I need the girl alive.
Her name is a rallying cry for the rebels. Wouldn't it be better to simply execute her?
The Queen slammed her fist down on the throne and had the pleasure of seeing him jump.
Did you hear me, Benin?
Yes, Majesty. Alive. I understand.
But the Queen no longer trusted him. Would Dukat ever turn against her? No loyalty seemed certain anymore. She thought wistfully of Beryl, her old chamberlain, who would have walked into fire on her command. But Beryl was dead, and in his place the Queen now had Juliet, who seemed always to be whispering. Even now Julie was forgetting herself, lounging against the wall and making eyes at one of the palace guards. The Queen's other pages were scattered around the room, barely even paying attention.
What else?
The army, Majesty.
Dukat ventured, shooting an uneasy glance at the two men behind him.
It's a problem. Many of the soldiers refuse to return home after they were discharged. Large groups of soldiers hold meetings which they believe to be secret. We have reports of widespread public drunkenness and brawling all over Domain, and in the aftermath of broken furniture and abused women, the people blame you.
The Queen smiled, allowing some of her own spite to enter her voice.
Well, why don't you do something about it, Benin?
I no longer hold sway with my men, Majesty.
Dukat admitted stiffly.
They do not want platitudes or patriotism. They want their plunder, all the way down to the infantry. Failing that, they want to be paid in coin.
The Queen nodded. But what Dukat asked was impossible. She had always acted as her own treasurer, and she knew down to the mark how much money was in her vaults. She had reserves, but the flow of money had slowed considerably since the tear shipment had stopped. There certainly wasn't enough to pay the thousands of disaffected soldiers anything close to what they had expected to reap from the tear invasion. Briefly, the Queen considered paying them all a small fraction anyway. Such a gesture would empty the treasury, but sometimes gestures were necessary. The Queen had gambled thus several times before, and the gamble had always paid off. But something about the idea stuck in her craw. After all, she had not been paid either. The two-tier sapphires lay beneath her clothes, but they were only pretty baubles. All of the power, the invincibility she had hoped to gain from the Tyr invasion had been reduced to the empty trophies that now hung between her breasts. Upon her return to the palais, she had tried everything, every enchantment she knew, but the jewels would not speak to her. It was maddening. She had Tyr blood. At least the dark thing had told her so, and she should have been able to wield them. Where had their power gone? Dukat was still waiting for a solution, but the Queen had none to give. Her soldiers were children. She had compensated her high command generously so. What they chose to do with that money was their own problem.
This is my army, she finally replied. They work for me. If they forget, I can remind them.
Fear will only hold them for so long, Majesty.
Just watch, Benin.
Dukat wanted to argue further, she could tell, but after a moment he merely resumed his former defeated posture, hanging his head over his knees. For perhaps the 100th time, the Queen wondered what in holy hell the girl had done to him.